This is clearly a very popular session. So once again, while you are welcome to stand along the sides of the room and in back, please know that it is being simulcast in the room next door. Large screens, lots of comfy seats. So feel free to join us via live simulcast. But if you also want to be, as Hamilton, the musical, would say, in the room where it happened, we certainly welcome you to come in and cozy up and be a part of the conversation from here. So welcome, everyone. I am really thrilled to be a part of this conversation. I'm Laisha Ward, the EVP and Chief External Engagement Officer at Target, or Target, as I know some of you ladies say. And I'll be your MC for today's session, rather. And I'll be up here briefly, and I'm going to turn it over to these incredible women. So we're really thrilled to be here to support the advancement of women leaders across the state and around the country. And I'm excited that we're here with the incredible Emily Aries and this panel of extraordinary women to help you boss up and beat burnout. Woo. Something that we can all use, not only during the holidays, but I think all year round. Is that right? I don't know about you. I certainly can use those tips, and I'm really looking forward to it. We're proud to partner with the Massachusetts Conference for Women to celebrate women and the leadership roles that you play every day in all facets of your life, whether that's your career, at home, with your family, your friends, and your community. There are so many places in our lives where we as women are doing so much to not only improve our own lives, but the lives of others. Target's purpose is to help all families discover the joy of everyday life. And I think that's a great segue into today's session, where we're going to learn how to create more space and time for joy in our lives, something that we all deserve and need. So with that, let me introduce our speaker, Emily Aries, who is the founder and CEO of Bossed Up. Ooh, love that. CEO of Bossed Up. That's what I call myself at home with my husband. CEO of Bossed Up. So she's formerly the co-host of the podcast, Stuff Mom Never Told You. Aries fell in love with podcasts, and she launched Bossed Up's weekly podcast, where she talks with experts to tackle new career conundrums each week. That's a mouthful, career conundrums. Sure is. Aries has also been a contributor to Forbes magazine, an award-winning women's development coach, and her TED Talk, The Power of No, details how to set healthy boundaries and invest in their sustainable success. Also note, which I think is super exciting, that she is going to be signing copies of her new book in the exhibit hall after this session. Oh, they changed it. You're not signing copies?
Well, it's not out yet.
Oh, so that's... Okay, stay tuned. That's a little edit from my notes. So instead of that, you have to sort of stay tuned in May. It's
May
going to
21st.
Come out. Okay, so instead of that, you all are going to sort of bum rush the stage and just talk to her afterwards
Let's be
instead.
Friends online. We'll be pod pals.
Friends online. Yeah. There's lots of other ways. And then that will allow you then to make a note and get her book when it is out. So please join me in a warm welcome for Emily Aries, who will introduce the rest of our panel. Emily.
Thank you, Laisha. That was lovely. Thank you so much. All right, clearly we have nothing to talk about here, right? Mm-hmm. Burnout is not a common problem for any of us, as I can see by the packed house we have here. As Laisha mentioned, I am the founder and CEO of a little training company that I started 6 years ago now to really help all of us as women own our power to design our careers and lives with intention and agency. And I've spent the last 6 years helping women do that because that's the kind of organization I could have used when I was younger, personally. I started my career off in the high-octane world of campaigns and elections. I became the youngest state director in the nation, serving on behalf of then newly elected President Barack Obama. Woo! Yeah. And during the 3.5 years that I worked as a lobbyist and a campaigner and helped folks across the country really own their power to shape our future as a nation and to make their voices heard in Washington, I had lost the ability to do the same for myself. So I made a transition into figuring out how can I sustain the kind of change that I want to see in this world by first figuring out how I can sustain my personal life in order to make my career and the impact that I wanted to have. to get the full story on what a rocky journey that was. You'll have to pick up my book in May, but today's panel is really about the practical, tactical, and research-driven tools and strategies that we all can employ to take our power back. Unfortunately, we can't change the space-time continuum, so we won't be sharing tips on how to create more time necessarily today. Otherwise, we'd all be much wealthier women.
Yes.
But we are going to essentially leave you with tools to do the same, to really feel a broader sense of agency over your life. Now, for a bit of context on what burnout is, it's really, in a sense, the lack of agency over your life, or a lack of feeling like you have control, like you're in the driver's seat of your life. And just to acknowledge that this is a really serious, diagnosable mental health disorder, not just something you can flippantly say after a long week or being burnt out on the pumpkin spice latte trend, or whatever it might be. Burnout is a serious deal. In fact, it's characterized by its symptoms, which are feeling a sense of I'm not being effective. I have a lack of effectiveness in my life over the future of my work. None of us can relate to that, I'm sure. Physical and emotional exhaustion. Anyone there right now? I am. My book deadline is tomorrow, so I'm right there right now. And then cynicism and detachment. It doesn't matter what I say in this meeting. No one here is going to give me the promotion I so deserve. Or the work I'm doing every single day is lining the pockets of my boss, but it's not contributing to my purpose on this planet. Those components of burnout add up, and they can be a quick, slippery slope into even more serious and long-lasting mental health issues, like chronic anxiety, which we know that women suffer from in greater numbers than men, and depression. The good news, the silver lining here when it comes to burnout, is that this is a relatively easier mental health condition to begin to reverse. We have power. It's about seizing it and taking it back in a world that doesn't particularly like women who do that, okay? In a world that conditions all of us, especially if we have the audacity to become mothers, which a few of our panelists here have, to put everyone's needs before our own. So today, we're going to talk about the radical act, the feminist act, of taking care of yourself so that you can have the impact in this world, in our families, amongst our loved ones, or just because we deserve it, of being there fully present and having the impact that we want to have. So without further ado, I'm going to allow my incredible panelists here to take a moment to introduce themselves and give us a little bit of context on the perspective you bring to this topic of beating burnout and stepping up as the boss of your life. And we'll start with Dr. Lori here.
Yeah, so I'm Dr. Lori Santos. I'm a professor of psychology at Yale University and also head of one of their residential colleges. My research is all on cognitive biases and the kinds of bad strategies that we use to think. But in this new capacity as a head of college, I wound up really face-to-face with the mental health crisis that we see on our college campuses today, where over 40% of college students report being too depressed to function, and over 60% say that they're overwhelmingly anxious a lot of the time. So this is what I faced. And what I did was I developed a new class on the science of well-being, the simple tips that you could use to reduce burnout, to feel better, and to kind of tackle this mental health crisis. What was surprising was it became, the first time it was taught, became the largest class ever offered at Yale University, where one out of every four students took the class. So it's not just a packed house here. Whenever we talk about these issues, these things get packed. But my role on the panel today is really to take a scientific approach. What really does the science of psychology say about really simple things you can do to reduce burnout over time?
Awesome.
All right. So I'm going to give a totally different perspective on the panel today. So first of all, I am a mother, a daughter, a sister, a wife, a woman in tech. I'm also a Brit, a friend, and, oh, by the way, an owner of an incredibly demanding dog. Sound familiar to anyone? So I will be totally honest. Until I was invited to participate on the panel today, I actually hadn't given a huge amount of thought into how I've managed to balance a 30-plus year career in high tech with a 30-year marriage and raising a family as well. In fact, not only had I not thought much about it, I'm not sure I was ever comfortable exploring it, let alone speaking about it in front of so many people. And in fact, the reality is, I think for the largest part of my at least work life, career life, I've pretty much been white-knuckling, raising a family, and holding down a career in what I can tell you is an incredibly demanding industry, demanding in terms of time, travel, competitiveness, etc. And all of this since I do just want to mention, I graduated more years than I'm actually going to admit, but in the early 80s, as the only female with a computer science degree from the University of York in England. So many, many years ago. So, but I will tell you, now I have a daughter. She's in her 20s, and she's just embarking on her career, also in high-tech publishing. And she just graduated from, I will tell you, one of the most amazing educational institutions in the U.S., Barnard College. It is the all-female college of Columbia University, and they are dedicated to advancing women's opportunities and women's education. And I will tell you, she came out a screaming feminist, and I love it. And I am learning from her, and she's learning from me. Mm. So whether you're at the very start of your career like my daughter, or 30-plus years into your career like me, or anywhere in between, I hope you get a lot out of not just today's panel, mm-hmm. but the rest of the day. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. I'm Courtney Carver, and I have cycled through burnout for decades until the last decade when a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis invited me to say no more. Mm. I am an author. I wrote a book last year called Soulful Simplicity, and run a blog called Be More With Less, and share my journey to simplify my life and to eliminate stress. I forgot for so long that I had a choice in terms of what I allowed into my life and into my work and into my heart. But the moment I found out, and I'm a slow learner, so it took a while, but the moment I found out that I did have a choice, I started saying no to almost every form of stress that I had control over, and there's quite a bit of it, actually. So I hope to bring to the panel today my personal experience and experiments in simplifying to live a healthier, happier, more present life.
Excellent. And Courtney, will you be signing books after this panel?
I will.
Yay! So make sure you follow up with Courtney to get all of her tips and tricks and her really powerful experience over the past 10 years in her book. And as a quick plug, I want to invite you to start thinking of what questions you would ask these incredible women. Help me do my job today, would you? Because we're going to save time towards the end of our conversation, which we all know could go on for like 4 hours today. But I want to make sure to pass the mic to you here in the audience to ask your questions in just a little bit. A couple final plugs before we dive in. Dr. Lori's course, which was written about in the New York Times only, 2 weeks into launching it, has become a viral sensation, and you can actually get in on it on Coursera, where you can take an abbreviated version of the course for free. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Coursera.org, which is a wonderful platform where you can get all these free educational tools. The name of the class is called The Science of Wellbeing, so you can check it out for free. You basically get what all the Yale students have to pay a ton of money for. You can take their SATs, but you get the free version.
Yes, get it on the cheap. I love it. I like to start off these conversations with resources where you can follow up with us next while you all have your pens and notepads out. And as a shameless plug for myself, bossedup.com is where you can find everything I do, from free articles and resources and toolkits to a yearly planner that we are selling right now to help you achieve the kind of sustainable success that you want in 2019, and lots of other cool ways that we can be internet friends. Sound good? All right. So I want to dive into this instead of looking at the problem any closer. I really want to start talking through solutions. And I think the best place for us to start, something that we each have learned a little bit about, is with this concept of time affluence. So Dr. Lori, can you first explain to us what time affluence is and why it is so critically important for beating burnout and preventing burnout from really happening to you?
Yeah, so time affluence is this concept that lots of social scientists are talking about, and it's merely just this idea of having some free time, Like, you look at your schedule and it's not just all red. Like, there's like white blocks in there as well. It's the opposite of what most of us in this room are probably experiencing, which is time famine, where you're really starving for time. We often think that it's going to be impossible to carve out blocks in our calendar, that time affluence just can't work for us. But the fact is that most of us never try. Like, what would it really look like if you just today, you know, for January, next month, February, just carve out blocks that will be protected, and that's your time affluence time. What research shows is that it feels like when you think about doing that, it makes you a little anxious. You're like, oh my gosh, I can't, like, carve out time. But in fact, once you get time, it makes you feel like you have more time. So the act of carving yourself some time can actually free you from this, like, time-famished mentality. I think that's what we're learning from the research, is that when we're feeling time-famished, it's like we're starving, right? And so you don't pick the right kinds of foods, like, you're just, like, in a really bad state. Whereas if you just gift yourself some time, things can get better. And I can't help but tell but one quick story from my class at Yale. So these are Yale students who are incredibly time famished. I was going to give them a lecture on time affluence where they had to come to class and hear about this. And I thought, how ironic, like, I'm going to take up more of their time to do this. And so the exercise I gave them is that students came to class, and my teaching fellows were handing out a flyer. And the flyer said, today's lecture is about time affluence. To teach you what that is, I'm going to gift you some. There's no class today. And I had a big list of positive activities they could fill their time with rather than run off to the library and go study. And what was amazing was how the students reacted. So a lot of the students kind of spontaneously hugged me or one of the TFs. They kind of couldn't help it.
Thank you.
And two students burst into tears. And one of the students who burst into tears said this was the first free hour she's had all semester. Right? These are our young people. So gift yourself some. Put it in the calendar. Make it sacred.
Yes. I want to follow up on that concept with Sally. From a parenting perspective, what does it feel like to even consider having your kids do nothing for a day? Is that not a guilt-inducing state? Is that not like, are we not taught that we have to overschedule our family time and our children's time to constantly be improving them? Did you experience that at all with your family?
Oh, not at all. No. We're plunging right into it.
We are.
This is literally that chunk of my life where I remember my daughter was 4 months old, and I went straight back into work full throttle. Mm-hmm. And you suddenly realize, oh my God, I used to have it easy when I didn't have a family, and now you're plunging right into it. And by the way, daycare is easy when you get to school and figuring out curriculum days, school days, sick days, vacation days.
Right.
Planning and scheduling is really key. But on that subject, on planning and scheduling, I'm a big believer in totally scheduling and planning things ahead. As soon as the school calendar comes out, we put it straight into the business calendar. But it's a couple of things that I will say, and we were talking about this earlier. I have a 20-year-old son, and over Thanksgiving, I was just talking to him about, just in prep for this panel, so what do you remember when you were growing up? You know, when mom was working, dad was working, it was crazy. And he said, you know what, mom? It was a full life. You were always there. You know, you were there for school events. You were there for sports events. But he said, you know what, mom? We never had any white space. And that was my 20-year-old saying that to me at Thanksgiving. And I'm like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
So to Laura's point, it is so important. And there were two things that we did do. Friday evening for us when the kids were growing up, that was family time. That was our family white space. Mm. Probably wasn't enough. But when we all came back, work, you know, if we'd been traveling and everything else, that was our family time. And the other thing I will say is me time. Yeah. And Emily knows this firsthand.
Yeah.
On Sunday mornings was my time. So that was, everybody was in bed. I would get up at 5 a.m. and either hug a cup of coffee, organize my closet, catch up on email, do the bills. But that was my time. And you know, I still do that today. And my kids are now grown and out of the house. And I still get up. And I only mention it because Emily said to me when I met her last night, did you send me an email at 6 a.m. on Sunday morning?
About a panel about burnout?
About yes.
I was like, I have a moral obligation to not reply to this email for 24 hours at least.
And she didn't.
I didn't, yeah. But it was funny. I'm glad you shared that. Thank you. And I what I love hearing here is that being a type A scheduling junkie, raise your hand if you identify as that. Yes, me too. It's not the opposite of free time. if the concept of white space gives you a sense of anxiety or guilt already, that's a good sign to show us all that we need more of it in our lives. And guess what? You can put that bubble in your GCal just like any other bubble. But allowing yourself the gift of nothing happens here is so critically important. For my line of work, which is highly creative, right? Being a writer is making something out of nothing, right? Mm-hmm. I compare it to trying to juice a rock on occasion, right? When you have to be as creative as you can be, preserving your time and protecting yourself from constant interruptions, i.e. the open office floor plan trend mm-hmm. that we're all living through right now, we will survive this period of office design somehow. But it's about saying, for me, 8 a.m. to 12 p.m., in whatever time zone I happen to find myself in, I do not take meetings, I do not schedule calls. That is creative time. That's when I have to do the hardest work that I do, which is writing and creating and making things happen. So my question for you is, Courtney, sometimes we find ourselves proactively coming to a place in our lives and saying, I want to take a moment to reset my way forward in life and create more simplicity in my life proactively. And sometimes we are brought to those moments by a life-changing diagnosis. How did that experience for you inspire more simplicity in your life? And what were your biggest learnings from having to address the realities of the MS diagnosis in terms of how that really created more freedom and happiness in your own life in the long term?
How long do we have?
No. I know, right? Not a small question.
Before I answer that, I want to back up for just a minute and talk about that free time, this mm-hmm. elusive, amazing free time that we all wish we had. And then when we have it, we fill it up running errands and doing all the things we're supposed to do for the real time.
Yeah.
That's not free time. So free time is nothing. It's nothing. It's for you to do whatever you want during that time. So when you block that free time, don't say free time and then have 10 bullet points. Go to the grocery store, stop by the post office. Just make it free.
What do you do with your free time?
Oh, my free time. I hug my coffee as well. I love that you said that. I don't know if that's a British expression, but I thought about it. I hugged my coffee this morning. We're in a deep relationship.
Yeah. So
I hug my coffee. I take walks. Yeah. Sometimes I find myself writing. I might take a bath. Might call a friend. But I don't schedule it or plan it.
I like your philosophy on morning rituals, too, mm-hmm. right? Does that feel related to this?
I think my morning routine is mm-hmm. not free time. It's my morning routine time, but it's awesome time.
Yeah.
I really like it. But I'll swing back to to your question in that I didn't intentionally simplify my life. I didn't mean to simplify my life. I didn't know what minimalism was. I didn't really understand the concept of simplicity. All I knew was that if I didn't get rid of some stress, I was going to be really sick. My neurologist told me in no uncertain terms that if I didn't, he said, you're standing on the edge of a cliff. And based on your MRIs and your clinical exams, I just want to tell you that if you don't change, you're going to fall off this cliff. And I didn't want to go in that direction. And so all the research that I did pointed to stress. Mm. And I knew I had to start cutting back. I didn't know how I would do it or where I would start, but I ended up starting with diet and cutting stressful things from my diet. Did one thing at a time. I used to be this fast and furious, do it all in 21 days or less, and I'd have this magical life, and then I would just be back where I was at the end, burnt out from trying to change so hard. So slow and steady, one change at a time.
Yeah. I think what's critically important here is acknowledging that achieving the kind of restful, relaxing, lower stressed lifestyle that we all aspire to and spend millions of dollars on trying to achieve every year as an economy takes effort. It takes intention. It's kind of paradoxical because it takes mindful, consistent energy, which the most burnt out amongst us have the least. In fact, if you look at the science on your brains from a physiological standpoint, the more we experience stress, the more that the part of our brain that actually helps us regulate stress takes a hit. So if you have found yourself, whether it's right now or in the recent past, in a moment where you all of a sudden feel overwhelmed by things that wouldn't normally overwhelm you, it's probably your brain calling out for help and saying, we're under siege here. And so the world of positive psychology takes a different approach to figuring out not just how to keep our bodies from being under attack, but how to improve our own threshold of happiness, right? If we could promise you that in 30 days, you would have a higher rate of success, a higher rate of personal happiness and life satisfaction, I think there's a lot of products and services out there that do promise that, right? January is coming around, so it's the New Year's resolution industry complex that's about to be thrown your way. What are some of the tactics and strategies that you've found have worked for you, either from a scientific standpoint, from a trial and error standpoint, or from a necessity to really achieve the kind of boosted happiness and life satisfaction? Not just I feel less stressed all the time, but I actually create more space for happiness in my life.
Yeah. I think one of the great things that the research on happiness teaches us is that the simple hacks that you can do to bump up your well-being, they don't actually take that much time. Mm. They take work in the sense that you have to remember to do them. You have to find ways to turn them into a habit. But, you know, much like a lot of the simple habits we have that are healthy for us, like brushing our teeth or something like that, like, they don't actually take that much time when you get down to it. And so I'll give you two that I've found in my life work really well, and there's lots of science to back up. So one of these is just the simple act of taking time for gratitude. I mean, this is something we all hear. It's like, you know, on Oprah all the time, like, gratitude. But we forget how powerful it can really be.
Yes.
Like this, and it's something that can be really frustrating, because when you finally have some time, this is what I find myself doing. When I finally have some time and I can kind of meet my girlfriend over a glass of wine, I don't want to like be grateful and think of all the things I'm grateful for. I want to talk about all the hassles in my life. I'm like,
yeah,
talking about that one coworker is like, oh, you know. But that's actually not, but this is another, there's many cases where our minds kind of lie to us about what makes us happy, and this is one of them. It turns out that the simple act of taking a moment like that to really experience what you're grateful for can be really powerful. In fact, there's an exercise called the gratitude letter writing exercise, where you just write a letter of thank you to somebody that you really care about. Especially, it's especially good if it's someone that you haven't talked to in a long time. Mm. It turns out that this act of writing a letter of gratitude can boost your well-being for over 30 days. Just the simple 10-minute act of writing this letter and giving it to a person you care about. Now, again, like, you know, there's probably products on the market that are selling you, you know, like a 30-day boost in happiness. Like, if you buy this product, it's totally free. You don't have to buy a product.
Yeah.
Like, something in your house right now, a pen and a piece of paper, you could achieve it. The second quick thing I'll mention, again, another thing that doesn't take time but is really powerful, is the simple act of doing something nice for someone else. Especially when we're in the throes of burnout and stress, we're so focused on ourselves. Mm-hmm. We want to find ways to, like, treat ourselves. But it turns out that this is another spot where our minds lie to us. Like, the act of treating ourselves doesn't really boost up our well-being as much as, like, treating someone else. And it's, like, the simple kind of thing. Like, you know, you want to buy yourself a latte or a cupcake or get a quick massage. It turns out that the act of gifting that to someone else can actually boost your well-being more than you expect. Again, it's not what we forecast, but it's something that is there. And so I guess the message is, like, what the science teaches us is, like, you don't need that much time to do this stuff. You just have to stick it in your schedule. And you have to come to terms with the fact that sometimes your instincts about what feels good, like complaining or kind of treating yourself, they might not be right.
Right. And I also feel like there's this trend in the hashtag self-care Sunday Instagram type trend of almost binge working. And then I'll put in a massage on a Sunday and I'll feel better. And that's not really what we're talking about here. We're talking about micro adjustments.
That's right. And I think that this can kind of get to some of the themes that we've been hearing before, even that Courtney was mentioning, is, you know, sometimes when we try to do this self-care, if we do too much of it at once, then it's kind of defeating the purpose. It's like, I'm going to fix all the things right now. Like, that's not what this is about. It's about just kind of trying these really simple tactics that you add in that don't feel like a lot extra on your plate. They're just really simple things.
Mm. Sally, what kinds of tactics and strategies have worked best for you?
How much time?
I'm asking you all the hardest questions today, Sally.
All right, so where do I start? No, seriously, I actually did put some thought into this. And if, for me, boiling it all up into one simple thing, it is making sure that you focus and prioritize that finite amount of time and energy you have on the things that are important and that you want to be great at.
Mm.
And then specifically taking everything off the inevitable to-do list and or move them to best efforts And more than anything, just recognizing and acknowledging you don't have to be great at everything, and everything you do, you don't have to be great at. And can I tell you, my husband has absolutely no issues grasping that concept.
Right.
I mean, yes. He is happy to put on his, you know, take off his to-do list. And by the way, I usually make his to-do list. But seriously, men do not have that same problem. So, and I mean, I'll share, this is a little bit of a cliche, and I apologize for that, but it was the one that I could think of. Yes, I'm British. Yes, there's the British Bake Off contest. And yeah, English people have this, you know, we don't cook, and I'm one of them. Can I tell you, I don't. It was never important to me. I never thought, you know, I needed to be great at it. My mother didn't really help me there. So I've never really taken to cooking and baking, and that was fine. And then I had a family. And there was a social pressure of, well, what do you mean you don't cook for your kids every night? What do you mean you don't bake a homemade birthday cake for them when they're X years old? And, you know, at the end of the day, and there was some social pressures, and I felt that. But to this day, that was one thing of many that I took off the to-do list. And I still, and by the way, we eat out a lot, and I will absolutely acknowledge that both my husband and I were in careers where we had some funds to go out and eat. And that's not the case for everyone. But our kids at a very early age, we unconventionally spend a lot of time in restaurants.
Thank you for sharing that. I want to share a term in the research that's related here. It's called role overload. And I'm sure we can all get a sense of what that alludes to. But the fact of the matter is that we women are socially conditioned our entire lives to try to live up to what it means to be a good sister, a good daughter, a great mother, a great employee, a great boss. And those roles compete over our limited time and resources. And we as women are more likely to be juggling and multitasking those roles as compared to our male counterparts. It's just not as much of a social construct over that value, the good/bad mom value that comes with guilt. That's like the birthplace of shame, right? The dissonance between how we're doing and how we think we should be doing. So there's a couple of things we can do right away. One, let's stop shaming other women. Yeah? Can we all start there? And two, and I just wrote about this because I just hosted my first ever Friendsgiving, my Thanksgiving, with my now husband, which I'm not even used to saying yet. Brad the Boo and I hosted our first Thanksgiving, and I was stressed out because I had a lot of work deadlines to deal with, and I have no idea how to cook a turkey. And I'll bake a pie any day because that British Bake Off show is my biggest, I'm the biggest fan. Anyway, I looked at all the things that were on the docket for Thanksgiving and said, Brad, you don't know how to cook a turkey either, right? I'm like, I don't. He doesn't. I'm not going to take this thing on. Why do I have to bake the turkey or cook the whatever you do to a turkey, right? And mind you, my mother had already photocopied and mailed me a recipe and started unsolicited telling me every single step that it would take to brine and do whatever the hell you do to a turkey. And I said, here's Brad. Talk to him about it because I just passed your recipe on to him. And guess what? We can do that more often, asking for help, whether it's from the dudes in the spheres of our lives or not, but not assuming that being a good homemaker or being a good hostess or being a good daughter or sister or whatever is 100% on us. Let's change what it means to be a good anything and define it for ourselves. All right. I don't want to bogart the conversation, Courtney. So what have been the tools and tactics that have worked best for you?
Yeah, one thing I think that we can all do to feel less busy within a week's time is to stop telling each other how busy we are.
Yeah.
Okay? So we remind each other every day. Every single day we're in some conversation where you say, hi, how are you? And the answer is, I'm good but busy, fine but busy, good but crazy busy. Mm. Got it. We're busy. And then we email each other, I know you're busy, but can you do my thing? Right?
So real.
And a couple things come to mind with that. One, we're reinforcing this idea that we're even busier than we think we are. And we kind of feel like if we're not as busy as that person, maybe we're falling behind. And another thing is that we are missing an opportunity to connect with each other when we have those conversations. Because when I come up to you and say, hi, how are you? And you say, I'm so busy. What I hear is, I'm too busy to have this conversation with you right now, so don't ask me anything else. So I think if we could just try to remove the word busy for a full week, you'll notice a shift. And it might not be something that other people pick up on right away, but after your week, you can challenge people around you to do the same. So that's probably where I'd start.
Excellent. I also can't help but start to think about the ways in which power and privilege intersect with having control over our lives. Some of us are busy because we're trying to make ends meet and we're working three jobs and trying to not completely neglect our children, right? And conversations like this one can often leave out working class women like my mother, leave out communities of color who, on top of the daily stresses of just trying to make ends meet or rise up in our careers, are also dealing with microaggressions and racial battle fatigue of the day-to-day life that it feels like to be under attack in a culture that's still not sure it likes everybody based on skin tone or ethnicity or whatever you want to call it. So I wonder if we can, for just a moment, and I know this is a curveball question I give you no advance warning on, sorry, but where can all of us take more power over our own agency in our lives, regardless of financial status, regardless of a sense of power and privilege over our lives? I personally remember leaving a toxic relationship that was very scary to leave when I was at peak burnout. And I couch surfed for about 6 months. Actually, yeah, about 6 months as I was trying to get my footing and going into breakup debt, which is a real thing that we should all talk about more. Before I was able to have one of those clean slate moments in life that are so few and far between, but can be such an opportunity to rebuild your life on your own terms. And I didn't feel like I had any power in that moment. And yet, sometimes feeling powerlessness without a, you know, with a lack of resources or places to turn to, you can still find micro ways to take control over your day-to-day life. And I just remember the anxiety that comes with feeling like you are at rock bottom. Yeah. Where do you go from there? And have you ever felt that in your life? And this is my last toughest question. So
yeah,
thank you for
good.
Bearing
it's
with
good.
Me.
It's like a real. I mean, I'm glad you brought this issue up of privilege, right? Because I think sometimes when we talk even about concepts we've been talking about on the panel, things like time affluence and so on, you can think, well, that's all well and good if you don't have to work two jobs
right.
and you can afford to put your kids in daycare and that kind of thing. But I think the power of this approach is that there's so many simple things we can do to gain time affluence or all the kinds of things we're talking about. I like the way that Courtney put it earlier where she mentioned that we all have a choice. And I think there are a couple different choices that we can talk about. One is already what we've talked about, you know, you have a choice of what you put in the calendar. It might not feel like a choice, but ultimately it's your choice, right? You can take things out. This is something that you can do for yourself. Another spot where we have a choice that I think the science really speaks to is the choice of our mindset about things, right? Calling it busy versus calling it like opportunities or challenges or something like that. The way we frame things can make a big difference. And the Buddhists talk about this idea of whenever you're facing something that feels stressful, so stress is in your life and so on, not to hit yourself with what they call the second arrow, right? Some of you have heard this concept before. So what's the second arrow? So the first arrow is like that deadline that comes for your book or a breakup or something bad that happens in your life or traffic or whatever. That's the first arrow. That's not something you can control. But what you can have complete control over is your reaction to it. And that's the second arrow, right? Like you don't actually have to freak out about the traffic. You could reframe it and say, oh, I got an extra 6 minutes. I'll throw on my favorite 6-minute song, you know, on Spotify, right?
Or podcast.
Or listen to a fantastic Bossed Up podcast. But the point is that we forget that we have control over our reactions to things, but we always have that. And sometimes when the reaction is as tremendous and like how awful as it is, that's not the first thing. That's us stabbing ourselves with the second arrow. And so we can stop that.
What a beautiful, terrible metaphor, but an apt one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Underreacting is such a gift.
Tell us more about that. Underreacting.
I think just to take that whenever something happens, especially when you know someone would love to get a reaction from you.
Yes.
I mean, I think about people I know. I won't mention any names. And I just, instead of my feeling how I want to react, I just take a breath and I think, I'm just going to underreact. I'm going to back off. I'm going to go in and just take a minute, because I know that pause is going to be probably worse for one of us, for sure. But so many things that happen in our day-to-day lives, you know, we want to get all over it, when if we could just let it be for a minute, it may not even require a reaction from us.
I feel like that is an introvert superpower that extroverts like myself could learn a thing or two from. Taking a beat, feel how you feel, and not necessarily giving everyone else the right to know how you feel right away. Is that what you're saying?
Definitely. I mean, no one else gets that power over us.
Right.
We give it to them.
Amen.
So take it back.
We're all like turning into a church right now. Like the nods are like, yes. Okay, I feel you. I love it. The Church of Courtney, I'm in. Sally, any last words or thoughts on this? Especially, if I may,
yes,
add to my question here. The American take on success, power, achievement, constant working is fairly unique as compared to the rest of the world. We're the only country who pretends like nobody needs access to affordable childcare, hasn't dealt with parental leave policy, doesn't even have access to vacation days for all of our workers in the workforce. And that's part of our American exceptionalism, folks, because we are alone in that club when it comes to other developed nations who say, guess what, vacation is actually quite good for you as a worker and as a productive member of society. Do you feel like there's a privilege to almost having an international perspective on this? Or how have you seen it differently in different parts of the world?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I will say I've spent most of my career in the U.S.
Yes,
so coming with British Petroleum to the U.S. many years ago. But obviously my family is still in England. Well, maybe that's not obvious, but my family are still in England. And actually, my daughter, who I talked about, who's graduated, she actually now works in Amsterdam. And I will tell you, in Europe, there are a lot of things that they get right. And one of them is things like, 4-6 weeks vacation. I mean, that is... And I was also with a company, a Canadian-based company. Their maternity leave policy, like 1 to 2 years. Yeah, 1 year.
That's it, I'm moving
1 year. And I think 4 months, my first daughter, I was jamming it right back full throttle into a career. So I tell you, there are some differences, and there are things that they get right, and there's an expectation for that. Mm. And I think it is absolutely right. And I hate the fact that we don't have that same thing here in the U.S. And my daughter's feeling it now as well. And again, she's early on in her career, but she knows how... And by the way, there's a misnomer that some companies have unlimited vacation time. Can I tell you?
Yeah.
Mine does. Yeah. But what does that mean, unlimited vacation time? How many people actually have time to take them? I'm doing it, aren't I? So, so I do think there is a difference, for sure.
And I love hearing a more diverse global perspective on these conversations, which is something that I think we Americans could use a lot more of to have a better context as to where we fit into the global picture on work-life balance, on what it looks like to be personally sustainable in order to be more professionally sustainable as well. All the research shows that our burnout culture, it's not just our personal bouts of burnout, but our culture that normalizes burnout here in the United States is not great for companies, is not great for businesses' bottom lines, is not great for the stress-related health expenses that are plaguing our nation right now. So the research is very compelling that it's both a moral imperative, because we deserve what we're talking about here, and a business imperative, a national imperative, a public health crisis, if you want to look at it from every different macro and micro perspective. And in the very first chapter of my forthcoming book, I talk about something I call the martyrdom mindset. Because this stuff, this stuff goes all the way back to the Protestant work ethic, the folks who founded our nation on this idea that idleness is evil. And we are still carrying that psychological baggage layered upon gender roles that have transformed in the past 100 years, 50 years. I mean, the concept of women in mass being in the workforce is still relatively new from a generational standpoint. So when you combine women's insane expectations that are put upon us as to how to be the perfect 1950s housewife and the ass-kicking career lady, right, in stilettos, mm-hmm. how to master both of those domains layered on top of the Protestant work ethic leads us to this martyrdom mindset that tells us we must sacrifice our personal well-being in order to kick ass in every other domain. And I reject that. And I think we're all here today because we reject that. And now it is your turn to ask more questions of these incredible panelists as to how we can go about rejecting that. So there are two microphones in either alley here. Aisle, that's the word. Yes. Feel free to line up there, and we will call upon you and take as many questions as we can in the time that remains. Yes, please.
Hello. My name is Suzanne. I have my own business, mindfulness business.
What's the name, Suzanne, so we can all Google you. Be friends.
I'm still setting up my website.
Okay.
It's called Quiet Wellness.
Love it. Yes.
Yeah.
Self-promotion.
So,
yes.
But I'm very curious about your feedback and advice on minimizing. I feel I'm good at taking the time to meditate each day. Sometimes I even can do it for 20 minutes two times a day. But I find I have a difficult time minimizing, and that's not only buying one last gift for Christmas or taking on... I feel like I'm excited about helping individuals, especially in the mindfulness, opioid addicts, prisoners. I find a challenge in minimizing and focusing. And what's your advice on that?
Great question. Do you want to take that, Courtney?
Sure. So at 3 o'clock today, I'll be doing a whole hour on conscious minimalism and can go deeper for sure. But I would just start by experimenting and give yourself some challenges where for 2 weeks you're not going to buy anything new, or you're going to look through the list of the people that you want to serve and you're going to start with only three and not move on to anyone else until you've really, these three have become kind of the core of your business, and then expand from there if you so choose. But I think that what you'll find in putting some parameters and timelines around these boundaries that you create for yourself is that you'll be happier with less. And you'll do better work as a result of it.
Courtney, may I share the book that you're working on, or is that a top secret?
No, it's not a secret.
Tell us about 333, because I feel like this is so directly related, and I don't know about y'all, but when it comes to minimalism, the first thing I think about is my closet. And that's what she's working on right now. So tell us
about. I am going to talk more about this afternoon,
sure.
But Project 333 is a minimalist fashion challenge that will help you live with less, starting by dressing with less. And so essentially the rules are to choose 33 items, including clothing, jewelry, accessories, and shoes.
I knew it.
Not the shoes.
I'm wearing 33 items right now.
Yeah. Everyone's like, I'm not buying that book. And hide everything else. Don't get rid of it. Just hide it. Dress with those items for 3 months and see what happens.
Yes.
That's all I'll tell you for right now.
Yes. But check out the section on Courtney's website, Be More With Less. Is that right?
It is.
BeMoreWithLess.com. You can find the 333 Project to learn more. Because we have such a long line here, I'm going to go two here, and then I'm going to come back to you. Promise. All right, right here.
Good morning, and thank you so much for this. This has been amazing. My name is Annie, and my question is, as you move up in your career, I'm pretty much at the beginning of mine still, but as you move up in your career, we know that there's this pressure to be perfect, to have it all together. And you get these deadlines that are sometimes just ridiculous or crazy. And part of that is where the burnout is coming from. So how do you know, and when do you start to have those conversations? How do you, I guess, manage up with your superiors to know, hey, I'm burning out, but... you know, they're not comparing you to your peers so that yes, I'm burning out, but I see that they're doing all the work, but I'm also doing a lot of work. So when do you start to have those conversations, and how do you address it? How do you manage up so that you're still getting, you know,
yes,
good feedback?
Any with an N?
Yes.
Any.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for this question. Who here wants to dive in?
You want me? I'll tell you.
I'll chime in.
And I know I have people in the audience who actually are part of my team, so they're going to say, Sal, you do a lousy job of this. But
nice.
It's a great question, seriously. And from the perspective of somebody who manages people, whoever, it, for me, it's better to know. So if you feel that, you know, you're not going to make the deadline, or you're struggling or need help, and that's so difficult, I know sometimes, but raising that and asking for help earlier in the process is so much better. And it's tough for, and I think it's tough for us to sort of say, I need help, but that is by far the best way of managing it. And that's just purely from a, if you were working for me and I knew that you were, you know, you were having issues, that's what I would want to know. And then it's amazing what mm-hmm. you'll get in terms of support. So I hope that helps.
Can I also jump in? I think this is the kind of spot where I think our minds are not helping us, right? Because we forecast that, of course, our bosses or other folks on our teams will think less of us when this yeah. happens. But the fact that there are so many people in this room suggests that it's not like you privately by yourself and your company who's feeling this. Like, everyone's feeling this. And as a manager myself, as a professor, I manage, like, a lab and teams of students. What will often happen is, you know, they're scared of me thinking, like, oh, I have to meet this deadline. But then they send me something, and I'm like, oh, gosh, now I feel the pressure. I have to give them comments back on this really soon. And I send the comments soon, and they're like, oh, no, I have to, like, get it. And so none of us admit that this is going on and we don't talk about it, we can be reinforcing this in others.
Mm.
And you can think of your act of asking and sort of admitting this thing as a compassionate step, and the kind of step that can really seed change broadly. Because again, my guess is if you're feeling it, that the deadlines are just too much, other people are feeling that too.
Yeah.
You just have to take the courage to ask.
Can we also acknowledge that not all bosses are created equal on this mm-hmm. front?
Yeah.
Not all bosses are this cool, mm-hmm. okay? And that it's really actually a boss move to have this assertive conversation, because it requires a little bit of risk-taking. And risk-taking requires privilege and power. So if I'm afraid of making rent next week, I'm probably not going to tell my boss that I'm drowning in assignments and I feel like a failure or a fraud. And so it's very real to acknowledge, like, what are my options, worst-case scenario style? And ask yourself, it's actually a backwards way of looking at it, but if everything disappeared tomorrow, if this job didn't work out, if this is a toxic workplace and leaving it is the best thing I can possibly do for my health and well-being, what would I do next? How would I survive? How would I thrive? And knowing what your backup plan is in case of utter and complete failure as an entrepreneur was extremely empowering, because I had a business plan I was sitting on for years, spinning my wheels, thinking, what do I do now? And one of my mentors said, well, now you have to, like, start it and do the thing. And I said, but what if I fail? And she asked me that question, what if you fail? What would you do next? So know that there's privilege and power required to be courageous and take those risks. But then the boss moves to have that assertive conversation of saying, hey, I want to set expectations with you. If this deadline's been moved up to here, what else on my plate can be moved back? Or how can we reshuffle my priority list so that it aligns with your priorities? Mm-hmm. And to me, that's been a very effective strategy in showing the boss that you're trying to be proactive, because bad news does not age well, mm-hmm. as was already mentioned. And then from there, not beating yourself up about it and not saying this is a personal failure, it's a system failure. And seeing it yourself as part of the systemic solution to setting realistic deadlines, instead of what I call aspirational planning. I'm a recovering aspirational planner, and I still have to give myself permission to say no, which is the subject of my TEDx talk.
Uh-huh.
So if you want more on that, Google me. Thank you so much for the question, Annie.
That's good.
Did you have anything you wanted to add to that directly? Okay, over here.
Thank you. My name is Terry, and my question's for Courtney. Do you have a quick list of stress foods that you cut out of your diet?
I do. And I'm not a dietitian or a nutritionist. My doctor didn't recommend this, although he does support it based on my results. I cut out all animal meat. from my diet, and I did them one at a time, and I called them by their animal names so I would be more convinced to stop. So I stopped eating first chicken and turkey, and then cute pigs and cows, and then other animal products. And over the years, I've reassessed. I brought a little bit of seafood and clean fish back into my diet. I have dairy once in a while, but I try to limit it, and have also tried to limit a lot of processed food and pasta, which I love, but I feel better without it. And one thing that I do that has helped me year after year continue to refine what's good for my body is a nutritional reset called the Whole30. Anyone familiar with that? I would Google Whole30. It's pretty phenomenal. It's a 30-day reset of just eliminating. So you eliminate alcohol, sugar, grains, legumes. My husband says fun.
That's what I'm thinking, Connie.
But it's 30 days, and it's pretty phenomenal how quickly you can change your body. I'm not talking about body shape or weight or any of that, but just how you feel when you wake up in the morning, that you're actually awake if you're not eating a lot of these inflammatory foods.
So you've graduated from the 21-day challenges to 30 challenges.
I see. I love it. Thank you for that. Thank you for the question, Terry. Over here.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Ida. Thanks for the fireside chat. I've really enjoyed it. My question for you is, I feel like another component of adding time to your calendar is also saving time. So do you have any tools or any strategic aspect you've used in the past that have helped you to maximize time?
Yeah. Dr. Lori?
Yeah, so one of the techniques we use with our students is what we call a value matching exercise. And here's how it goes. You take a really big sheet of paper and you write down how you spend your day. And you really try to put like amounts of time in there. And this part of the exercise is really useful because it lets you see how you're really spending your time. Like you admit like, wow, email is like a lot. Or like, wow, Instagram is like more than I want to admit. Sleep is too late.
It's embarrassing.
So it's already informative when you do this. But then the second part of the exercise is more powerful. You just write down separately, try not to think about that, but write down what are your values? Like what are the things, you know, you value learning, you value moving up in your career. And then you try to look over and see what matches and what doesn't match. Mm. And quickly you realize that there's certain things that you're spending a lot of your time on that aren't working, mm-hmm. right? You know, email is one of them. It's like, you know, yes, you have to do email at work, but like maybe the interaction that you're having with email or the amount of time doesn't work. Social media is often another one. You know, some of us are influencers. You got to be on Instagram and so on. But a lot of us are killing a lot of time that's there. And so what you can use this exercise to do is to figure out where are their holes. Because sometimes you're like, wait, I just actually have to minimize these other things because I'm crowding out the things that really matter.
Absolutely. And as a final shameless plug here for a moment, I am a behavioral psychology and cognitive science geek, which is why I'm such a fan of Dr. Lori here. And the tool that I put together that's now in planner form is something I've tested with my board of advisors and with thousands of women over the past 5 years. It's called the Bossed Up Life Tracker. And it takes a whole bunch of science around how women experience basically time confetti, fractured segments of time in which we're pulled in so many directions at once that we don't feel like we have focused, intentional moments of intense focus in our lives, and really put it all together into one planner. And I just thought of this, since you're all here and you've stuck around and you've been such an enthusiastic and wonderful audience, I will put together a discount code just for all of you, for MA Women. That'll be the discount code. If you do want the Bossed Up Life Tracker Planner, I'll tweet out the link, or you can Google it and find it in my online shop for 20% off for MA Women at checkout. I hope it's helpful to you. It's been very fun to put it together and see thousands of women use it.
I would say, too, in terms of saving time, really watch the meaningless decisions that you're making during the day. Like, how long do you think about what you're going to eat for lunch or dinner or what you're going to wear in the morning? Like, start to streamline those decisions as much as possible because, I mean, I could waste an hour trying on outfits in the morning, hating every one of them.
Yes.
And then I'd finally go to work in the same thing I wore 2 days prior. So now I just do that automatically. I'm like, I'm going to wear that same thing. I don't care.
I love that. Yeah. Preventing decision fatigue, right?
Correct.
Sally, any last words?
No, I'm all, yep.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much. We're going to stick around. If you have more questions, come talk to us. Thank you so much.